This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome to the first Curators Talk for 2008, and it's lovely to see so many of you here. I'm Carolyn Forster, and I'm President of the Friends, and this is a very successful series for us. And before I introduce Michelle, I'll just mention that we have more talks in the pipeline for you. And so if you check your program, we have one in March and, of course, one in February and one in May, which are already organised. So you might just like to check your program and so that you can put those in your diary. Now, we're delighted that Michelle is here this afternoon to talk to us. And it's about John Gore's telescope. I was going to say a little bit, but Michelle will be able to tell you a lot better than I will anything about this subject. Michelle's been with us for quite some while now.
Yeah, 3 years.
3 years, and it was wonderful that you came across from the library.
I think so.
I think we're absolutely delighted that you're here with us. And so, Michelle, thank you so much for speaking to the Friends today.
Thank you, Caroline, and thank you also to the Friends for making this opportunity available for curators to come and talk to some of our great supporters. Now, it's my pleasure today to talk to you about a very beautiful and significant object. I use the word object in a slightly elastic sense, as you'll see, that entered the National Museum's collections officially in 2006. Now, this is John Gore's telescope. And as you can see, there are two eyepieces, a lens and a lens cap. So those are down here. And the original mahogany tube and the leather coating that used to keep it all together. Now, there are a few other bits and pieces. And on display, our lovely conservation section have actually brought some of the more robust pieces for you to have a chance to have a look at more closely. Now, this was the condition the telescope was in when it came to the museum. And it was the gift of John Galloway, who's in Queensland, and he is the great-great-great-grandson of John Gore, who entered the Navy in the 1750s and ended up becoming a captain and having a very major role to play in Cook's three Pacific voyages, well, two of Cook's Pacific voyages in particular. Now, this is Captain Gore. Obviously, being at sea for a long period of time doesn't improve your looks. but I'm sure his family loved him. And this is a painting by John Webber, who was the artist on Cook's third voyage. It was painted in about 1780, and it would have been painted in part to create an image of Gore that could then be engraved for use in the official account of the third voyage. But more of Captain Gore later. Now, here we see one of the long eyepieces. This is the night and day eyepiece. This is the day-only eyepiece, and the little metal sleeve that is at the eye end of the telescope. And here is an engraving on the night and day telescope eyepiece, Dolland, London, day or night. Okay, that tells us it's an astronomical telescope and that it was made by the very famous family of London opticians, Dolland, sometimes referred to as the House of Dolland. And here is Peter Dolland's trade card. His shop was known as the Golden Spectacles and the Quadrant, or rather, his shop was at the sign of the Golden Spectacles and Quadrant. And we can see an example or examples of the sorts of materials that he supplied to the London populace. In this top corner, we've got one of those little pocket globes, which now go for considerable sums on the market. And we also have an eyepiece on the other top corner next to a sundial. And within the image itself, we've got a quadrant, the telescope, a microscope, the spectacles, and I'm not quite sure what that object that looks like a book suspended from a thermometer might be. I hope somebody will be able to tell me, perhaps. Now, okay, we'll just go back to that one. The House of Dolland began in about 1750 when Peter Dolland set himself up as a spectacle maker and sort of basic optician. There was a huge market in London amongst the scientifically literate, which extended much more widely than we would consider. How would I put it? You did not need to have a proper scientific education as supplied by the universities as you do these days to be considered something of a scientist, because of course the universities were not teaching science as it would come to be known by us. You just needed to have the money to pursue your interest, access to books, most of which were written in Latin and Greek, although increasingly, fortunately for the British, mathematical textbooks were increasingly produced in English. And if you were a gentleman and had these interests, you could become a member of the Royal Society, provided somebody put your name forward and you were approved by the fellows. Now, within that group in society, there was a lot of amateur practice of science. Okay, so they didn't see why they shouldn't also have a telescope, why they shouldn't also, use all the equipment that was becoming available so that they too could look at astronomical events as they happened. So London is becoming, at this point, this is mid-18th century, one of the major centres for scientific and navigational instruments, and they have a flourishing opticians or optical scientists equipment set up. Okay, now Peter was the grandson of a Huguenot weaver. His father, John, had followed his father into the silk weaving industry in London, but his great passion, John's, was science, and he could read Latin and Greek, and he'd studied mathematics and was in an excellent position to be a fantastic optician. So 2 years after Peter sets up his business, John joins him, and he begins to do some work on one of the basic problems with telescopes. And this is the point at which we begin a crash course in optics. I hope you'll all bear with me. I had to learn all of this to understand about the object. Okay, this is a convex lens. Now, before I begin on this, I should say that in 1608, Hans Lippershey, who was a Dutch optician, invented the telescope. There is considerable evidence to suggest that it was one of those inventions that was about to happen in multiple places around Europe. So there were a number of other opticians and scientists who were working on this, but it's Hans Lippershey who gets his name attached to the development. Within a year, 1609, Galileo Galilei has heard of this fantastic new instrument, has made one for himself, and has pointed it at the sky. Apparently nobody had thought about that in the preceding year. And he quickly discovered the craters on the moon, the sunspots, 4 of the satellites for Jupiter, the phases of Venus. And this was using a telescope that had a field of vision that was as wide as a piece of spaghetti held at arm's length. Okay, tiny. It's amazing how he managed to do it, but he did. And in 1611, the problem with the field of view width was solved to an extent by Kepler, who created a telescope using 2 convex lenses, one at the objective, that's the big round end, and one at the eyepiece end. However, Kepler's telescope did not solve the major problem with telescopes, and that has to do with the way light refracts. Now, light going through a plain sheet of glass in a straight direction will continue in a straight direction as it comes out the other side. But if it hits the glass at an angle, it will refract, which means it will break up into its constituent parts, because, of course, white light is composed of the spectrum, the colour spectrum. Well, that's going to cause a few problems, because also, once, light passes through air at a certain speed, but when it passes through through glass, it goes at 1.5 times slower speed. And that's called the index of refraction, which is about 1.5 for most types of ordinary glass. Now, in this example that we've got up here, you've got a convex lens, and as the glass hits one face of the lens, it bends, and then as it comes out of the lens, it bends a second time. So you've got the light bending and refracting. Now, there's a problem with that because the different wavelengths of light travel at slightly different speeds, and the blue at one end travels slightly faster than the red at the other. And the point of best focus, as shown on this image, is actually the green wavelength. And not surprisingly, the human eye is happiest with the green wavelength. So what happens as the light comes out of the lens? The blue part of the spectrum focuses first. Then you get to the green spectrum, which is the bit we're happiest looking at. And then the red spectrum focuses. And so what you end up with is, at the point of focus, a lovely little clear spot, but it is surrounded by a blurry haze of the colour purple. Okay. Now, this one's jumping the gun a bit. Okay, so they've got these telescopes and smallish field of vision, but they can still see amazing things, but they have what's called chromatic aberration. That's what the purple ring is referred to as. And it seriously compromises the amount of detail that you can see. They tried very hard to fix this problem, and they discovered that the longer the length of the telescope, the less the chromatic aberration was a problem. But when the telescopes reached the length of 150 feet, and they still had difficulty, they began to realise that, in fact, you know, there is a point at which you can no longer aim this telescope accurately. So it was sort of, you know, what do we do about this? And a lot of people thought about it, and even Newton spent considerable time trying to work out a way of dealing with this problem. And, in fact, he ended up publishing his opinion that it could not be solved. He felt it was inherent. Because, of course, if you make the glass less curved, you know, everything they tried didn't work, basically. And then, in about 1731, a gentleman called Mr. Chester Hall was doing a small experiment and decided that if you had glass of two different refractibilities, so refraction indexes, you could cause the way the light is bent to correct itself as it goes through. So what we see here is a flint lens, that's one with the flat surface, and that's a concave lens, nestled into a crown glass, and that's sort of like ordinary glass, convex glass. Oh, and I must say, Newton didn't just give up. What he did was he invented the reflecting telescope, which entirely does away with chromatic aberration, and it uses a curved mirror to bend or to bend the light within the telescope. The only problem was, at the time he invented this, they couldn't make a sufficiently smooth curved mirror for it to work as well as it nowadays can. Okay, so Chester Moore, who was an amateur, a gentleman of science, sent off his instructions for grinding both the flint and the crown lenses, and he sent them to two separate opticians in London. And unfortunately for him, in a way, those two opticians sent them to a third gentleman, Mr. George Bass, who, receiving these two orders at much the same time, worked out that they were for the same person, put them together and discovered, in fact, that here was the answer to chromatic aberration. So as we can see, the light comes through the flint lens and the blue is bent. You know, so the blue and the red lights, are bent and then bent back again so that they both focus at exactly the same point. Okay. This is the lens from the Gore telescope. And as you can see, the lens itself has been broken but what that allows us to see is that it is in fact an achromatic lens. It has a flint lens and a crown lens together. And fortunately, we have with us Hermann Weiner, who's an optician, sorry, Herman, an astronomer who's been involved with the Canberra, I'm having trouble remembering, the fantastic astronomy, the observatory that we have. Stromlo, thank you. And Herman, who's been looking at this, tells us that there is in fact a special glue that we can use to put this back together again, which will make the lens viewable, which will be fantastic. Okay, so this is an achromatic lens produced by Dolland, and this was a major breakthrough. Chester Moore, after he'd discovered that this worked, did nothing with it. He just did nothing with it, just left it in his drawer. And then in 1758, John Dolland published a paper through the, well, in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, although he was not at that point a member, so it had to be put forward by somebody else, outlining how to make an achromatic lens, or a lens that did away with chromatic aberration. For his pains, he was made a fellow. He won the Copley Medal, which was the major prize issued by the Royal Society for the best piece of scientific discovery in the year. And he was also appointed the King's optician. He was given a patent for his discovery, which he apparently had no great desire to pursue the protection of, but his son Peter had a very different outlook. Okay, this is what the telescope may have looked like when it was first put together. And I don't think you'll be able to read all of those details, but I'm hoping we can use this to help us with the reconstruction of the telescope, for that is our aim. Our aim is to put the telescope back together again the way it was. We're not going to sort of renovate it particularly, but we are going to turn it back into a usable telescope. And it will then go on display in the Australian Journeys Gallery, which is currently being redeveloped and opens late in 2008. Okay. Now, John only lived till 1761. He died shortly after all of this extraordinary work on his part. And he died at a point at which his son Peter was beginning to pursue people who were infringing his copyright or his patent. And there was a lot of anger amongst the opticians of London, 35 of whom signed a petition against Peter Dolland, saying, Chester Moore invented this a good 30 years ago. I don't see why we shouldn't be allowed to do it ourselves without this patent. It went to court, and in the end, the judge decided that it was not the person who discovered something but then kept the discovery locked in his escritoire, as the judge says, but he who makes it available to everybody else who should have the benefit of the discovery. Now, this is a picture of the Royal Observatory painted in 1682, not long after it was established by Charles II, near Greenwich. The reason why I'm showing you this is because one of the reasons why the achromatic telescope was such a fantastic discovery and why the British were so pleased that the problem had been solved was because as a maritime nation, most of Britain's military encounters took place at sea. They were able to put most of their money, most of their defence budget into the Navy because unlike most of their rivals in Europe, they did not have to maintain a large standing army to guard their borders. The sea did that for them pretty well. But there was a major problem with having a Navy at that time, and that was working out where exactly your ships were. This is the problem of longitude. And I'm sure many of you will have read Darvis Sabell's excellent and entertaining book on the discovery of an effective method for calculating longitude. So I won't go into it in great length here. But in order to solve this problem, the British state, the Crown, had instituted a Royal Observatory, had instituted the post of Astronomer Royal, which at this point was held by Neville Maskelyne, and it was sort of part of an unusually organised official programme in improving navigational science. In this, the British were decades ahead of their European rivals. Back to John Gore. Now, John Gore, as I say, was thought to be a native of America. We think he might have been born in about 1729-30 in Virginia, but he came to England quite early on in his young adult life, in as much as we can tell. We still need to find out much more about John Gore. He is a relative of Al Gore, or rather Al Gore is a relative of his. And also Gore Vidal. The Gore family have done very well for themselves indeed. Now, I'll just go back to that other one because you don't need to look at this just yet. No, back. Previous. Okay. Joining the Royal Navy in the 1750s was an excellent way of advancing quickly through the ranks because Britain was about to start or becoming fully involved in what is known as the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763. And this is a war that redrew the colonial possessions of European powers, and France largely lost her toehold in Canada and her toehold in India. Spain was no longer in a position to insist on what she saw as her exclusive rights over the Pacific, and Britain came out with lots of lovely colonies and basically open slather in the Pacific. And shortly after the ink dried on the Treaty of Paris, the British set off for the Pacific, and they set off in 1764 with... starts with B. I've written it down somewhere. Sorry? Wallace. The one before Wallace. Oh, of course, Byron. Yeah. So Byron sets off in 64 on the Dolphin, and he carries with him as master's mate young John Gore. Okay. They don't find very much. A lot of water, not a lot of land. I think they found Pitcairn, but I'm not sure. That could have been Carteret. Anyway, it wasn't a great success, and they'd only been back 3 months since 1766 when they were sent off again. Again, the Dolphin, and this time with Wallace as the captain, Samuel Wallace, and also with a consort ship, the Sparrow? I think it was the Sparrow, under Carteret, or Carteret, as he's sometimes called. That voyage was only marginally more successful, and the success lay in the fact that the Wallace's ship discovered Tahiti, which they called King George's Island. Now, fortunately, the purser on board this ship had been trained by Neville Maskelyne to calculate longitude. All the techniques that you do for longitude involve being able to calculate the time at the port that you left from and the time at the place that you're in at present, and then calculating, because, you know, for so many minutes in time, you pass so many miles around the Earth. And, of course, clocks at this point were not working at sea, and all sorts of strange things like injuring a dog in London and having a dog on the ship in your ship that would wail with pain in sympathy with the dog in London. You know, all sorts of bizarre things. They hadn't worked. What had worked was that Tobias Meyer, a German mathematician, had worked out a set of what he called lunar distance tables. So from any point that you are on Earth, actually I won't go into it because I'll just get confused, but anyway, these fantastic tables allowed you to work out by measuring the distance between the moon and certain other astronomical features your position on the Earth. The complicated mathematics required took about 3 hours, the calculations. But as I say, the purser knew how to do this, and he was able to calculate the location of Tahiti using longitude and latitude and therefore get a fix on it. Because, of course, the other thing was people would discover things in the Pacific and then not be able to find them again. And when he got back to England, shortly before Cook's voyage was about to set out, they now had a place in the Pacific from which to observe the transit of Venus, which was the whole point of Cook's voyage, apparently. Gore had been on Wallace's trip as well, and he spent some time during the month that the ship was at Tahiti learning the language and doing a major examination of what was going on inland in the island. A report was written on it by him, which he gave to the Admiralty. And he also told them that he was sure he had seen the great south land just on the horizon. Okay. This excited the British government very much because they were hoping to find something like the New World, the Americas, in the Pacific. That was their great wish. And that was what Cook's secret instructions when going out to observe the transit of Venus told him to find and claim for Britain. Now, Gore, because he's a bit of an old hand at Tahiti and speaks the language, is selected to go on Cook's voyage. And they don't actually seem to have got on terribly well. There's a letter from Sir Charles Blagden, who was secretary to the Royal Society for many, many years, especially during Banks's interminable presidency, writing that Solander had told him that Cook didn't really like Gore, and the suggestion is that Cook felt a little uncomfortable. He'd previously only been in charge of crews of about 20, and now here he was with nearly 100 men under his command on a ship, and that there were people on board the ship like Gore who knew much more about the Pacific and who could speak Tahitian when he could not. He certainly sent Lieutenant Gore off to do all the negotiations with the local people that they visited. He was in charge of the watering parties, the parties sent out to get wood, the parties sent out to make contact. But Lieutenant Gore's unshakable belief in the existence of a Great South Land resulted in some rather superior comments. I think the tone is superior on Cook's part. And Banks, I must say, shared Gore's hopes. Do I need to read this out loud? Can people see it, or have you? You're all fine? Good. Okay, so we can see here the lengths at which Cook was prepared to go to prove to people like Gore and, of course, Banks, that the cloud that they could see on the horizon was not hiding the Great South Land. They began to call it sort of Cape Flyaway, this sort of land that just constantly disappeared or retreated in front of you the closer you got. So, you know, he's basically saying here that he spent a day and a half going after a bunch of cloud on the horizon just to prove to Gore that there was nothing there. And having done that, he then writes, "I would like to have done more work to find the Great South Land, but given that the ship wasn't in any condition to sail east back across the Pacific, I decided to go up the coast of New Holland." So for those people out there who still think that Cook discovered the Great South Land, also known as Australia, he didn't. He knew Australia was New Holland, and, you know, he thought he'd just go up the coast and see what was there. Okay. Now, this is Joseph Banks, and Joseph Banks got on terribly well with Gore because Gore had one skill in particular that was of enormous use. He was a great shot. Unfortunately, he was also the first person to have killed a Maori with the gun during a trade altercation, but the other thing he did was he shot the first kangaroo, and the kangaroo that was taken back by Mr. Banks, and its skin reconstituted in a fairly uncomfortable-looking position and painted by George Stubbs, famous 18th-century painter of horses, amongst other things. And this is the engraving of Stubbs's painting that appears in the official account of the first voyage. Now, as most of us will be aware, Banks intended to go on the second voyage, Cook's second voyage to the Pacific, which was going to be looking for the Great South Land. But the changes he had made to the ship to ensure his personal comfort this time caused the ship to become so unseaworthy that they thought it was going to turn turtle as it sailed the quiet waters of the Thames. So all of that was dismantled, and Banks was furious and ended up not going on the second voyage. And interestingly enough, Gore did not go on the second voyage. He instead went with Banks to Iceland, which shows that Gore knew where the best patronage lay. The third voyage, Gore is back. Cook is heading out yet again, this time to find the Northwest Passage, and Gore decides to go on this ship, this voyage, and he's on the Resolution. Cook dies on the beach at Kealakekua Bay, and it was on the 14th of February. The anniversary is tomorrow, so next time people say Valentine's Day, think, no, no, anniversary of the death of Captain Cook. And so the captain of the consort ship, who was Charles Clark, became the captain of the Resolution, Cook's ship, and Gore was made captain of the Discovery, the consort ship. They head off up to the northwest coast, or looking for a northwest passage between northern Canada and across into the top of the Pacific, and they were trying to get across into the Atlantic. Of course, that will become more and more navigable as time goes on with global warming, but at that point it was entirely unsailable. And Clark then dies of TB and is buried in the Russian section near Kamchatka. So now Gore is the commander of the whole expedition, and he manages to bring both ships home with very little further loss of life, arriving in about April 1780. It took them a whole month. There were such terrible storms in the channel that they actually sailed up around Scotland to get into the Thames. Now, so we've ended, so we'll go back. Previous, we'll stay there. So what happens to Gore after that? And how do we know that this was his telescope? Well, now these are the sorts of things that as curators here at the National Museum we spend a lot of our time doing. And I wrote what's called an object biography for the telescope. The best way we know that it belonged to Gore is that it has been handed down through the family. And that's, you know, usually that's part of its provenance. The date of the telescope, which we can fix between 1761, because Dolland London is the name that Peter Dolland uses for his company after his father's death, and the fact that it has brazed tubes rather than drawn brass tubes means that it was made by 1783, at which point that new technology was being introduced. So we have a period, 1761 to 1783, which encompasses Gore's career very nicely. Gore largely retired after he got back from the Pacific that third time, and in fact took up Cook's position at the hospital, the Greenwich Hospital. So Cook had been made a captain of the Greenwich Hospital, which was basically just it was like having a pension and somewhere nice to live as a thank you from the state. And when Cook failed to come home, his rooms were allocated to Gore. And Gore dies in the 1790s. Now, how would somebody as a master's mate at the earliest point have had the money to buy a rather expensive telescope? They cost up to 12 guineas for the really big ones. And this one has a very large objective for the time. Its objective is 2¾ inches, which was as big as they were made for the, you know, as the general sale item. You could commission a bigger objective, but it depended on whether the glass was available. They had real troubles casting glass without striations at this point. And I think, we're still checking all of this out, but I think the answer is that his capacity to shoot the wildlife and his capacity to deal with the locals meant that he was able to come back to England with a fine collection of specimens and objects which would have been very keenly sought after by gentlemen collectors back in London, one of whom, Banks, had become his patron. So there is a suggestion that perhaps Banks gave him the telescope. Well, he may have, but perhaps he didn't have to. Perhaps he had put Gore in a financial position where he was able to purchase it for himself. Right. Now, how are we going for time? Oh, we're nearly there. Now, I'm never quite sure how to finish these things, so you'll have to bear with me. Okay, so Gore died at Greenwich in 1790, and Banks was the executor of his will. And before heading out on the third voyage, Banks had received a letter from Gore asking him to keep an eye on his son. So I think, you know, I think the nature of the relationship, one had to be very respectful towards Banks, but I think the nature of the relationship was good. That son grew up and joined the Navy. He was also called John Gore. And he came to Australia with his family in 1834. So that's how the telescope gets to Australia. Now, our plans for the telescope, as I said, are that it will be put back together again. And you possibly notice the two young women working here installing. One of them is Prue Castles, and she's a conservator, and it's her role to put the telescope back together again. with advice. And she's undertaking a research project herself at the moment to try and work out what would be the best way to treat this object. Everything that comes into our collections has to be assessed, and if it requires treatment, that treatment's given to it, especially before it goes on display. Now, the telescope will become part of a module in the Australian Journeys that talks about European voyages of discovery. And from my point of view, it's the most fantastic object to tell that story because of its significance in astronomy, the necessity of astronomical readings for navigation, British power in the Navy and the navigational field, which leads to the discovery of the east coast of Australia in particular, which inevitably, it seems, has led to the establishment of a British colony in Australia, and here we all are today. So, any questions? I'll leave you all looking stunned. Yes?
You said that the gentleman sent the specifications for the glass to two different people. You mean he sent one piece to one and one
no,
to another?
No, what he did was he sent instructions saying, I require a crown convex lens so high, so wide, ground to these specifications. And to the other optician he sent one saying, I require a lens made of flint glass.
That's what I with meant,
a, yeah. So basically he would not have been in a position to grind the glass himself, I don't think, although it's possible.
But he sent orders each for one piece to two different people.
Yes, obviously hoping to keep his discovery to himself for a bit longer.
Okay, thanks.
Well, there was a pretty big American community in London, just as there would be a large Australian one 100 years later.
Yes.
I think of the painters John West and John Singleton Copley. There might be papers that some of them have left and even have been put together by American historical societies into some kind of volume.
Well,
so that's a possibility. And I guess that there are American genealogical societies that would be very interested in the Gore family and might have traced the entire family tree, but those are both just guesses.
Yeah, the Gore family themselves are very busily examining their own family tree, and they say they cannot find much more information about him at this point.
Yeah.
Joe Parker was the curator here at the museum at the time who met Mr. Galloway and was involved in the acquisition of the telescope, and she's sent off for John Gore's will and John Gore's logbook and all sorts of things like that. I'm waiting for them to arrive soon, I hope. There are lots of sources that need to be checked, but they all involve a lot of time and a lot of reading on microfilm readers and, you know, trying to understand 18th century handwriting and things like that. And, of course, there are always many other calls on our time. But it is the sort of project that it would just be fantastic to be able to find out, you know, how did he get his hands on this? Did it improve his prospects within the Navy? You know, I'm a great astronomer. Look at the way I can calculate longitude. Of course, the whole issue with the longitude is improved with the next voyage when they take the chronometers. But that first Cook voyage using the Maskelyne's nautical tables is the one where the use of a telescope would have been particularly important. Oh, you think? Well, he could have, except that an astronomical telescope will show you the image of what you're looking at upside down at this point. So it might have been a bit hard to focus.
And stuck together, and if so, what did they use?
They are placed so closely together that I'm not sure that they would have needed an adhesive of any kind. I'll ask Hermann about this. But they're sort of effectively put into a frame that pushes them together.
Michelle, thank you for giving us such a marvellous insight into this extraordinary item. And we'll all look forward very much to seeing it in its new home later in the year. Thank you once again for making this item.
My pleasure.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.